This is episode number 19 of the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm Dan Benjamin. I'm joined today by my co-host, the grandfather of the web, Jeffrey Zeldman. It's great to have you here. Before we introduce our excellent guest, I'll tell you about our sponsor today. It's Environment for Humans, creators of quality web design conferences. Go beyond Google searches and incomplete, out-of-date online tutorials. Environment for Humans online conferences brings the experts to your desktop. How do you like that? These online events dive deeper into specific web design topics, giving you the opportunity to expand your understanding and sharpen your skills. You get all the knowledge and inspiration without the hassles and expense of travel. Check them out at environmentsforhumans.com. And there's a coupon, Big Web Show, 20% off the registration price for any of the conferences. So we'll see you there. Jeffrey, perhaps you can now introduce our amazing guest.
You do that very well, Dan. I gotta say, you should do this for a living.
I'll consider that.
It's fabulous. This is Jeffrey Zeldman here, and with us today is the very wonderful Aaron with two R's, Walter. Funny story about that name, which I'm sure we'll get to. But so Aaron is a very prolific web standards oriented designer, developer, and author. He wrote one of my favorite all-time web design and web standards books called Building Findable Websites, Web Standards, SEO, and Beyond, which was published by New Riders in 2008. Wow, 2008. That was already 2 years ago. That's amazing. It's the book that talks about search engine optimization in terms of accessible semantic markup. It's a good book. It's a good book for people who make websites and for their clients, really, because every client wants SEO, and the more we can do with web standards, the better. He's also the lead user experience designer for MailChimp, where he has experimented with such things as a MailChimp, for those who don't know, is a fun web-based email marketing and list management app. We use it for A Book Apart and an Event Apart. It's a great app, great web app. And Aaron is responsible for helping to make it easy to use and for making it fun, which, you know, you don't usually think of list management and fun going together. But he's also a contributor to the lead, in fact, of the WASP, Web Standards Project's Interact Curriculum Project, which basically is doing for colleges what they cannot do for themselves, right? Because web education is not where it should be in a lot of computer science and design curricula. So WASP is trying to fill that need. And there are a lot of talented people working on that. But Aaron is the leader, I believe, still. And and he's working on a new book on emotional design, which I'm going to really want to hear about, too. So, Aaron, hi. Let's start with the name.
Hello. So I've got a funny first name. I mean, it's a very common name, but my dad misspelled my name at the hospital. And so when I was on my birth certificate, it just, you know, it becomes legal and it's a pain in the neck to change. Plus, it makes it easy for me to get my username on social networks. That's why my first name is my Twitter handle. So it wasn't that I was necessarily the first guy to register the name Aaron, but the first guy with two R's, that is.
Wow. And Elvis Presley's brother had that same spelling, correct?
I thought it was Elvis's middle name was spelled that way. I could be wrong. I don't remember.
Right. Elvis Aaron Presley. Well, I don't remember either.
Something to that effect. Yeah.
You're living up to your namesake today.
Yeah. Okay. So we're done with the story. Thank you. That's been wonderful. And I guess let's start, because I'm sure a lot of people want to hear about this SEO findability web standards.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
So I wrote this book a couple years ago, as you mentioned, Building Findable Websites, and people don't just find your website through search. There are lots of other ways that people discover content. I also felt like there's pretty clear divide and quite a bit of animosity between the camps of the SEO folks out there and the standardistas you guys. And you know, there's and just kind of the general web community. And basically, what's happened is, you know, people want to get, they want to make money. You know, they've got businesses, they're trying to get their business out there. They've got a message. There are, you know, hundreds of millions of websites on the web at the moment, and being one in a hundred, you know, a couple hundred million is very difficult to get to your audience. So, people. I have faith in humanity, but sometimes humanity goes down the wrong path and people just get super focused, hyper focused on getting to the top of those search rankings. Right. And they do some nefarious things to get there. In fact, BMW, the German BMW site in, I think it was like 2007, they did a bunch of black hat SEO stuff, and they got caught by Google and blacklisted. And I'm sure someone's head rolled for that in BMW. That was, I mean, that's pretty huge for a major corporation like that to be blacklisted. And basically what happens is, you know, they had to go groveling to Google, tell them how they would change it, why they would never do it in the future. It's kind of like, you know, as someone that grew up Catholic, it kind of sounds like doing penance. You know, you have to do this penance and to get back in there. So at any rate, back to, you know, why this book and the topic. And I feel like there's this divide between SEO folks and people building websites. But I feel like there's a right way to do this. And a lot of us that are building sites with standards, we've read your book, and you know, people are on board with that idea, and it's a big part of the way they conduct their business. And then they feel like, oh, I've got to go hire an expert, and that expert comes in and messes with markup and maybe does bad things. But we really don't. I kind of feel like we can do this ourselves. That we can just learn to build for humans first. And at the same time, make sure that our content is accessible to machines as well, which is going to help us reach more humans to make it more findable. So, you know, using standards in your markup, clear information hierarchy with headings and strong emphasis, logical link text, logical title text, and not stuffing that with a bunch of junk like what we used to do in the late 90s with the meta element until Google came along and said, yeah, we're not going to look at that element. We're just going to look at the content in the page and index on that. And then, of course, you know, people started gaming the system in the side of the content of the page. So that's kind of where I'm coming from on that. And I also like to think of things like micro formats as an important part of findability, because if you think about it in the physical world, when we lose objects, and then we find it and we say, okay, I want to make sure I don't lose that again, like your keys. People lose their keys all the time. So what they do to solve that problem is they put their keys on a hook next to their door. So when they come in the house, they just put it on the hook so they know where to find it. This object is portable, and they put it in a location where they can rediscover it. And micro formats let us do that on the web. They make regular content just in regular old markup with some standardized pattern elements and classes and stuff around it. They make that content portable so I can move it to my address book so I can rediscover it. I can move it over to a calendar so I can set an alarm and not forget an event that I might have discovered on upcoming or you know, another website that's publishing a lot of micro format content. So that doesn't have anything to do with SEO necessarily, but it has everything to do with human behavior and the way that humans rediscover content. So
sure, it makes your content something that I don't go to the website to look at necessarily, but that I can pull from the website, that I can interact with, that becomes part of my life, my calendar.
Exactly.
Getting back to the SEO aspect of it just for a minute, you mentioned very quickly like five different things people could work on. And, you know, I mean, obviously your premise makes sense. If clients need this, and we're already designing and building their sites, it makes sense for us to know how to do this or how to do as much of it as possible. Then maybe they bring in an expert to work on something else, but essentially they have a very good, strong foundation in terms of findability. But if you could just take us through a couple of the things you mentioned a little bit more slowly. You said something about logical titles, and I don't know what that means. What are you talking about there?
So the title element in the head of the document, where we basically say this is the name of the website, or we put the name of the page. Right. That content is really important because that content shows up on a search results page, on Google search results page, as the title of the result there. So it's kind of, if we think about, information hierarchy of our message, it's kind of top of the food chain. It really needs to communicate clearly, this is what my content is, this is the name of the website, and it might say briefly what it's about. So this is a tricky one. You want to kind of jam all of that stuff in there, but without being verbose and without being spammy, where you're putting in a million different words and so forth. This is where someone like Christina Halverson and a content strategist, or that thinking is really important about what words are we using to describe who we are. It's about branding, it's about, business, and it's about content, and it's not about gaming. It's thinking about humans first, not about computers. But what I do is, a homepage, I'd have the name of the site. Let's take, for example, a list of parts. If I were writing the title text, for a list apart, I would put in something like a list apart for people who make websites, because that describes what this is about. And at the same time, it's describing the publication, and it also is communicating, by saying people who make websites. The term website is kind of an important descriptor of the content and a way that people might discover that content as well.
Okay, and then on an article page, it wouldn't start with a list apart. You'd start with the title of the article or what the article is about, correct?
Yeah, title of the article. And then maybe it's followed by a list apart. So, it's got the name of the publication.
So in your book, you have a whole bunch of standard white hat SEO techniques, right? Basically. And where those intersect with good HTML practices, you explain how that works. But it's not. But you are doing SEO too in the book. You're not just saying if you use semantic markup and make your most important headline in H1, and your second most, and your subtopic in H2, then everybody will find your content and you're done. You're not. It's not as simple as that. If it was that simple, you wouldn't need to have written your book. So it's sort of a combination of white hat techniques and good semantic markup.
Yeah, and part of it, so the semantic markup stuff is important to communicate to computers. And then there's another part, which is, understanding what the human behavior is around your content. How do people look for this content? And there are lots of really nice tools out there. There's a website, ranks.nl, and there's a subpage within there. I don't remember what the URL is, but ranks.nl, where you can basically say, this is how I would describe my website, or this is the content that I think that people would be putting into a search engine to try to find my website. And it will look at your website. You give it your URL and the keywords that you're evaluating against, and it'll say, this word shows up 27 times, or it shows up this percentage, it's got this prominence. And that can help you understand how your content is being viewed by a search engine. Now, it's not exactly like putting on the eyes of Google and looking exactly at your content, but it's a really nice way, it gives you nice insight to see how you can adjust your content. And also, it's good if for people that have black hat tendencies, you can see when your content density, like a keyword density gets a little bit too high. There's a 7% threshold. So words in the English language tend to not repeat themselves more than 7% of the time in a given body of text. in a natural way. So, you know, anything below 7% is natural.
Yeah. Anyone who thinks that hasn't talked to my uncle, but okay.
So maybe he could use ranks.nl to rethink his message. But at any rate, so that's a tool that you can use to try to get a sense for how your message is being seen on search engines, how you can kind of massage that a bit more. It's honestly a bit of alchemy to try to see how do I adjust my content, what's too much, what's not enough of describing your site. But again, you know, not to beat a dead horse here, you always keep in mind, is what I'm doing helping my audience or is it hurting my audience? I always like to frame the idea of findability in the context of user experience, because really what we're doing is helping people find what they want. It's not just about helping your bottom line.
So there's finding what you want, and then there's helping people want what you have, right? Which I think is where the emotional design that you're starting to write about now comes in, right? Because it's not, and I know that you've experimented with these techniques on MailChimp, so maybe you could start there. Like, what is emotional design, and what's the thinking behind it?
So this is something, you know, for the past couple of years since I've been working at MailChimp, I just sort of been experimenting with, and MailChimp already kind of had this personality going on. You know, it's got a goofy brand. It's a fun, goofy brand that that people like, that they like, that that there's a sense of humor, that there's a joke that's cracked, you know, on every page, that, you know, there's some piece of emotional engagement. It's not just all business, that there's some emotional engagement there. So that was kind of there from the beginning, and we've been experimenting and trying to foster that forward. But the idea with emotional design, and it's not something that I came up with by any means. Donald Norman wrote a wonderful book by that exact same title, Emotional Design, came out, you know, two or three years ago. His was exploring more like products that we fall in love with and why we love that. But and it's definitely a layered discipline. But I was noticing that a lot of web apps specifically, they started to basically shoot for a low bar. They wanted to make a really usable web app. And, you know, I think that's admirable, and that's a really cool thing. And as far as I can tell, I think that is from the revolution that 37 Signals has created. They've done such a good job of innovating and in communicating clearly that usability and clarity of message is central to what they're trying to do. And they've published a lot of books around this. They blog about it. And they've made a huge impact on our industry, which I think has influenced a lot of not only web app designers, but designers in general. They just sort of feel like, okay, let's just do everything that 37 Signals says. And that's a fantastic place to start. And the thing that I was noticing when I started at MailChimp was it felt a little bit different. And so I, you know, was given just this great opportunity to experiment and do whatever, you know, I saw fit on the application. And our CEO and I, Ben Chestnut, we were kind of going back and forth of like, you know, should a web app be just functional, or can it feel more like a website, where websites, they're more visually engaging, they're more, they can be informal, that sort of thing. And so we wanted to try to experiment with that idea. So there are some Easter eggs that are built in throughout the application. There's this one thing, there's just a, you know, Freddy von Chimpenheimer, this the name of the chimp, our mascot, and he's on every page. He's not helping you do something. He's not in a workflow. He's just present, you know, in the header. And if you see him, great. If you don't, it's okay. That's a key part of this emotional engagement that we've been exploring, is don't get in the way of a person's workflow. But you know, he cracks a joke. You know, he might say something like, "Why am I smiling, you ask?" Because I'm not wearing any pants. And people see that, you know, they happen to catch it when they're doing something that might be a really mundane task. They might be, you know, they might be a secretary. They might be working for their boss, managing their mailing list or creating an email to send out to their audience. And it's just, you know, they're in a cube. You know, it's kind of maybe not a fun thing to do. It feels a little bit tedious. If you give people that little something, if you just go beyond making it usable and you can make it emotionally engaging, people just, they absolutely just fall in love with you. They fall in love with your product, and they just want to use it more and more. In fact, I've seen customers that say that they just log into the app, not because they have anything to do, but because they miss the little jokes. They miss the little things. And so it's not just, I've got to say, I see this happening with a lot of web apps right now, like Vimeo has a lot of these great illustrations. It's got an informal aesthetic to it that people love. There are other, you know, it's not just about
humor. I would say that started with Flickr, I think, didn't it? A lot of us fancy that we had some kind of fun going on in our sites, but Flickr really owned that, man. They really just in everything that they, every little thing that they did, they seemed, and they kind of set a bar that then you see like Twitter with the fail whale and other sites emulating and going, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's be relaxed and fun and smart about this. Like we're talking to our friends, not be corporate and uptight.
Yeah. Right. Because, I totally buy that Flickr's the first mover, and they continue to carry that through. And, you know, I love that they do it in a way, you know, you log in and they'll greet you in a foreign language, and it just feels, it's informal, and it instantly sets a tone for this is what it feels like to use this application. It feels fun. It's a tiny thing. It's a small thing that they can do here and there. But setting that mood with your audience, it's huge. I mean, I think skeptics don't really see the value in that. But when you go to a party and you meet someone, think about the first conversation that you have with them and think about the tone of that conversation. If it's formal and stuffy, you know, they're probably not going to hang out and talk to you that long. They're not going to connect with you. But, you know, Jeffrey, I've heard you say that when you talk to clients for the first time, you like to crack a joke to see how they'll react. And if they respond well, then this is someone you want to work with. And if they don't get it, then you feel like, warning flag, I don't know if this is going to work out. And, you know, that's the thing, is that sometimes when we're on the web, we get so so excited about tool and process that we lose sight of the humanness of what we're really doing on the web. We're creating these global connections, and we can't underestimate the significance of what's happening in history, that there's a bunch of people coming together and meeting and sharing things. And if we can share those human skills in the things that we make on a day-to-day basis, then I feel like, you know, we can engage our audience better. We can make better products.
So a lot of this, what you're describing, is just, it kind of happens naturally in non-business sites. It kind of happens naturally on someone's Tumblr blog, right? Or on a small community site. If you remember when Josh Davis had Dreamless, right? It was a community for, or if you look at Metafilter, right, which is one of the a pioneering site, I don't know whether you'd call it a blog or a group blog or a social network, but it's Metafilter. It's its own thing. But there's sort of like rules that develop. There's jokes that develop, and there's a kind of camaraderie that's based and shared languages, you know, shared little language tricks. That happens naturally on Metafilter and Twitter and places like that. How do you get that? How do you go about creating that same kind of connection when you're selling trusses or shoes or something? How do you bring that same kind of connection, that emotional appeal, to a web app or to an e-commerce site or something like that? You know, the stuff that most of the people listening to this program have to work on, right? Whether it's their own or it's a client's. How do you, and you've obviously done it with MailChimp, so what are some of the techniques?
So I think that we should maybe take one step back and say that, you know, cracking a joke is not appropriate in every website. So for example, if you've ever used mint.com, which is an amazing app, it's one of my favorite web apps out there. It aggregates all your financial data into one site, which is great because then you can find out like what your spending habits are and you can react accordingly and, you know, become a better consumer.
And then Google and Facebook. And then Google and Facebook know how much you're spending and on what?
No, not exactly. But but yeah, so it's you know, a private space. You know, it's only for you to see all of that stuff. But the point is that this is a situation that if I were writing the copy for that or if I were designing the interface, there's no way I would crack a joke there, because you're asking for just significant trust from a person. They're going to enter things like their bank account numbers, all of them. They're going to enter, you know, their mortgage information, their investment information, that sort of thing. And so there's emotional engagement. It's not just about, you know, cracking a joke. It's about, you know, what is emotionally correct for the situation. And I think that, you know, when it comes down to like, what are the techniques I use in a situation, it depends first on what the message is and your audience in that context. But
sure.
It's just about being honest. Like, how would I talk to this person? If I could talk to this person that is using my website one-on-one, what kind of tone would I use? Who is that person? Another thing, you know, I had a client a while back that asked me to build a website for them. And he said something really brilliant to me. He said, okay, so this website is Parker Posey. So I want you to design this to be Parker Posey. And I thought, well, that is the most descriptive and terse way to say this is my brand and this is how I want to communicate with my audience, is that he was basically associating that with a personality. And, you know, if you've seen Parker Posey's movies, you know that she's sassy. She's no nonsense. She doesn't take any crap. She's smart and confident. And so that sort of thing. Yeah, exactly. So if you can sort of like, if you're creating a new site or a new application, if you can think about like, who is this? Who is this this brand? Who is this application that I'm creating? What's the personal connection I'm going to create here?
Wow. When I was in advertising, we used to say, if this product was a person, who would it be? And all that stuff. And a lot of what you're describing sounds like kind of classic advertising thinking, which is just, you know, make something relatable. You know, you don't sell soap by, right? You don't sell soap by saying, you know, describing the content of cleansing ingredients. You talk about how it makes you feel, or
yes,
that it makes up, you know, that it can get even a man's dirty hands clean, or that it makes a woman feel young, or whatever. You know,
yes.
Going back to the 50s for that stuff. But and so it sounds like you're talking about that kind of that, bringing that same, as if it's almost like you're saying, all right, we figured out how to make websites and we figured out how to make them usable. We figured out what our customers want to do, and we're making pathways and big buttons to help them do those things.
Yes.
Now, how can we make it emotionally engaging? How can we go beyond that? In a way, it's almost like you're trying to provide an answer to, this is terrible. I'm blanking on this, but remember, why are there no designs? Why are there no web designs as effective as, you know, as memorable as a great graphic design poster? Why is graphic design so rich? Remember that controversy?
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah, I mean, you hit it on the head when you said that, you know, a product is not what it does, it's how it makes you feel. It's what we see every week from Don Draper in Mad Men, really.
Right.
You know, it's that human connection, here's the story. And how that story manifests itself, it can be through microcopy and error messages, in warnings, in like greetings, in Easter eggs that are tucked in. Just even in like, you know, basic, you know, like a paragraph, introductory paragraph about a website or an organization, that, you know, use language that is a little softer, that is, you know, the right reading level, and it doesn't sound cold. You know, there's an art to writing really great copy, and I think that copy is definitely a huge part of creating emotional engagement.
So, Aaron, how much of this then is about the copy, and how much of this is about the design aspect of it? Because a lot of the people who listen to this show, I think, are designers, but there's a fair share who spend all of their time writing copy. And there are probably a handful of developers who wouldn't know the first thing about creating a design, but they're comfortable using a grid system to design a straightforward, you know, website. And they're thinking, man, I can't do that level of graphic design. Can I still take advantage of this stuff? Is this still the kind of thing that I can embed in a site, even though I'm, you know, design challenged?
Yeah, design, you know, what percentage is design, what percentage is copy? I'd say that it's all 100%, that I don't really see the two as separate, that I, you know, the term design in this context is big D design. It's problem solving design. It's, you know, designing a system. And that applies to people that make a website or an application beautiful. It applies to the people that make it functional, and it applies to the people that, you know, provide the content, that all of that stuff kind of works in conjunction. But, you know, even things like in design, using a grid system and, you know, using proportions that are human, using typefaces that are human, that, and by human, I mean, like, we can use, you know, even making a decision like, I want to include a lot of white space here. Why do we include a lot of white space? It's because in our physical space, if we go into, let's say, a person's house that's cluttered, we feel cramped. We feel like we don't have enough space to move. We feel uncomfortable. If we go into someone's house that's really well organized, it's got, you know, generous space on, you know, around chairs, and, you know, the living space is movable. You can move about that space. You feel comfortable. You feel like you can be yourself. You can sit down, have a conversation. It changes who we are. And that's what architects think about. And that's really what designers do. So even those fundamental, like, core design principles about grid systems and white space and typefaces that we choose have an impact on the way that we feel when we're using a product or a website. And of course, you know, designing websites with a sense of humor, where, you know, we're starting to see a lot of illustration make its way into to websites. In fact, you know, it seems like every website, new website that's launched, has some elaborate illustration. And I think that the reason why is because people really respond, you know, to a pretty picture. And, you know, that sounds a little maybe slightly cynical towards design a little bit, but, you know, people respond to that beauty, that there's a human connection. They can see something that's representative. There's a place for themselves in that message. You know, even, you know, things like color choices, really hot color choices can impact a mood. Cool color choices can impact a mood. So I think that emotional design is about all of those things working in concert instead of working separately. I don't really anticipate a single person being responsible for emotional design. I kind of see that as the responsibility for you know, everyone is doing that is as sure. a developer, you're writing, you know, content sometimes, whether you want to or not.
So it's a whole brand discussion that the company has, or the organization has, or who are we, who are we talking to, how should we talk to them? And then some of it works itself out as content strategy, some of it works itself out as design. But that's nice, because just like in client work, where you have a set of goals, and you can, when things get crazy, when the client's going, I'm not sure I like this, but I don't know if I don't like it, and everyone's confused, you can point back to, well, what are the users looking for? What did they say they needed? You know, who are we designing this for? What did we learn about what kind of things they respond to? You can always point back to this sort of learning, or this little Bible that you have, that when, you know, or compass. I'm just going to throw metaphors out until one of them sticks. But right, but I think what you're saying is, if you have these discussions, then you can go, you know, the copy doesn't feel right because it's not addressing, this is fun, but I'm serious, or whatever it happens, whatever it happens to be, or wow, that's really beautiful, but the cool sci-fi techno-futuristic world that you've done probably doesn't work for Moms Just Know, which is our, you know, it sounds like you kind of want to create a line, or you know, a series of statements, And then the design and the copy need to support those statements, even if you never make those statements public, right? Even if the audience never sees them.
Yeah, I'll tell you something that I do as a little private practice. I know that other companies do this as well, but I write you just in a plain text file when I'm working on you know, a design, or I'm working on stuff, new stuff for MailChimp. I have design values that I'll list, and you know, it'll be abstract things. You know, like it might be something like I want it done yesterday. You know, a statement like that. And it's something that I'm reminding myself, okay, this workflow needs to be fast and efficient because my audience is under a time crunch, that inevitably this audience is in this situation. And I'm, basically what I'm doing is trying to create like an emotional dossier of who's doing what in this application. And kind of drawing out, these are the parameters. It's not a persona. I don't really, you know, I find myself, I don't often do a lot of personas at MailChimp because we are we're sort of have this luxury that we are to some extent our own audience, and so we kind of get that audience already. But you know, creating these design value lists, I'm trying to think of a few others that I have listed on there.
Courage is a nice one. I always think of Dan Rather. Remember Dan Rather ending the news every night? Courage.
Yes.
I think that would be fun. I need to make a website that the word is courage, but nobody knows, and just see what happens.
TiVo has done that as well. Yeah. TiVo created a list of design values, and I've tried to track down, to see if any companies have actually published their design values, but they're really hard to find because they tend to be internal documents that people don't really share. But you know, I think TiVo had one design value that was something like, it's a TV, stupid. That kind of relates to, you know, directs their interface design ideas. And again, ties back to the fact that a person would be sitting on the couch, they would have a remote control. What is their emotional, state at that point when they're trying to use this product?
Or like a potato chip fell on the floor, but it's only been there for a minute. It's probably fine.
I've got a question here that I wanted to relay from the chat. This is from somebody named Vaso Krita, I guess. I'm not sure. We'll go with that. The question is there a suggestion that we think that we are able to communicate in a different tone on the web as we are along other mediums? And something that I'm reminded of is quite a few years ago, if you think back when Monster.com had this incredibly strong presence on the web. It was an incredibly boring, straightforward site that was about finding a job or finding an employee. It was a tedious site to use, but everybody used it to find their jobs, especially at that time. But then you'd watch their Super Bowl commercials and you get a completely different vibe about Monster.com. And that back then, that was how you got your branding out. That was how you got your message out. You communicated it on TV or on the radio or somewhere else, and then you'd go to the site and it's like there was all business on the site.
Yeah.
That seems to have changed too. So back to the original question with that in mind, do you feel that there is a different message to communicate or a different way to communicate that message online?
I don't think so. I think it's still the same. I feel like there's something slightly different on the web in that I feel like, you know, we do have the leeway to be a bit more informal. That I think has to do with the fact that social networking is such a prominent part of our life, that we're much more willing to share our personal selves with the world, with strangers online. I think partly because it's not as scary when you don't see the person face to face versus in real life. You know, you probably would say things on Twitter that you might not say to a person face to face, which is a little bit ironic because there could be, you know, bigger repercussions on a social network. But I think that has a big influence of, you know, audience expectations on the web, that and their willingness to have a potentially informal relationship, a more intimate relationship with a brand or, you know, a website. But, you know, I think that I don't know that that's hugely different. You know, on TV, there's a lot of informality. There's, you know, a million, you know, fart jokes in beer commercials and so forth. And that's right. about as informal as it gets. But so I don't think that the web is unique in that respect. But there's definitely, you know, a shift in privacy expectations on the web and that sort of thing that's happening right now that I do think is opening people up a bit.
Well, this is probably where we've got to end. I think we've got a limited amount of time for this show, but we could probably spend another 45 minutes talking about this stuff. It's great to have you as a guest today. Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
All right. Thanks, Aaron. You were great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks again to our guest today, Aaron Walter, for joining us. You can check out aaronwalter.com, two R's, to learn about what he's doing. Thanks again to Environments for Humans for sponsoring this episode. Check them out, environmentsforhumans.com, and use the Big Web Show coupon to get your 20% off. And thanks very much to you for listening. You can hear past episodes of this show and find out about all of our other shows by visiting 5x5.tv. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating the show on iTunes. It's the best way to help new listeners find out about the show. This is Dan Benjamin for The Big Web Show. We'll see you again next week.